Hello and welcome to Culture File with me, Luke Clancy, and a spring-like collection of stories involving an extremely wide range of tapping noises. This time we're assessing the durability of neo-Gothic stone carving as a career in contemporary New York, with one of the cities not so common as they used to be, stone carvers. And later, Paddy Woodworth suggests a new, old volume about New England for his ideal shelf of nature writing. But we begin this time in our first church of the week to worship at the altar of Vivaldi. Percussionist James Larter and his collaborator Freddie Waxman recently gave the premiere of their Rhythm of the Seasons, a radical reboot of the Four Seasons, reinterpreted for percussion. The event was at what was once James Cubitt's Romanesque Revival Welsh Chapel in Charing Cross Road, London. There, in the half-light of the endlessly reverberant stone nest, I met James Larter and the team as they prepared to get tapping.
So we're here at the Stone Nest in central London, and this is the afternoon before the performance of the Four Seasons reimagined for percussion concerto with figure ensemble. And we've just approached my percussion cage. I've got some unpitched instruments here. I have a marimba. I have the dreamy world of the vibraphone. I'm going to start actually the whole piece with the famous excerpt from Spring.
That's not usually how it sounds, though.
That's definitely not how it sounds. And I think what Freddie Waxman and I have tried to create is something that's very, it's a very eccentric take on the Four Seasons. So even when the violin has its first solo moment, doing it on triangles and little kind of bird spring-like sounds.
Tell us what's on that. You've got a little table of torture instruments in front of you there. What's on that table? What were you doing there?
So I'm playing this little table each time. This is kind of like a what I like to call like miniatures. So I'm playing everything with chopsticks. It's quite appropriate because we're in Chinatown. And so I've got some cowbells here. Very delicate and miniature. Right behind me, I have this vibraphone with a cymbal and two gongs. So in the second movement of Spring, we hear the gongs, which I was kind of thinking of. I was inspired by Debussy and Messiaen. You get kind of like a flowery garden type sound. I think this says a lot about. I've got this little bell, then two triangles, castanet, woodblock, and a little frog. And it's also a little table to hold my sticks.
You're picking those things for the tuning of them.
Like... I wouldn't say so much tuning, but kind of the shape of the melody. So lots of range. So high sounds. Going right down to more wooden sounds from the wood blocks. But yeah, every time that I play this table, it's kind of about the piece and how good the piece is. is the fact that we can start with... And you get a sense of what it is. So I think in terms of that, I think it will make the audience realize how strong the rhythmic qualities are in the piece. And it's all about, when you play percussion instruments, it's all about, I think, the way that you phrase things. It's very simple just to play.
So other than being a percussionist, what was it that set you off thinking the Four Seasons needed percussion reimagining?
It's not really something that struck me, but I've always loved the Four Seasons. I grew up listening to the Nigel Kennedy version. I used to have it on a cassette. But Freddie Waxman came to me with this mad idea, as he always does. And I was game, because I think it was a challenge. The notes themselves are challenging. There's lots of them. especially if you're...
Too many?
No, just the right amount. Especially when you're moving around different instruments. But then I thought, on another level, it would be quite an amazing challenge to create something new and innovative and inventive, and in moments really push the boundaries, and then in other moments just let the piece speak for itself. In this type of music, and I think in music in general, there's, the way I think of it is, there's tension and there's release. And in phrases, when you build up to a phrase at the top of a phrase, and then you have the release where you feel like the phrase goes downwards. So in dynamic terms, you've got... That's tension. So release. I think that goes for kind of anything, really. I mean, I have these philosophical thoughts about tension and release in life, but I'll save you that.
I am Freddie Waxman. I'm the artistic director of Figure and the musical director for tonight.
What do you think that an audience can learn from the way you've moved on this piece?
What can they learn?
They learn anything.
They learn anything. Well, I hadn't quite imagined this as a didactic experience, but I think it will be a really fresh way of listening to a very familiar piece.
Is that the problem that you're solving, that even its deconstruction has been so intense in the last few years that it's very hard to hear it?
Yeah, you know, you have Max Richter's amazing transformation of the piece, which has, when did you write that, 10 years ago, something like that, which has done wonders for its being even more popular. I don't know that it's a problem, because I think that the original music is great, and in a live performance there's always something fresh that can be found, but this is more radical, I suppose. And because we're stuck closely to Vivaldi's themes, but are presenting them in this very different way, I think it's like I've sort of rotated the kaleidoscope of sound.
Are you thinking that this will be a recorded project, or is this just a live experiment?
I hope to record it. I mean, I hope to do more performances of it. But yeah, let's see how it goes tonight.
Yes, it all worked out fine, and we'll hear some more of James's other music in a little while, but before that, we stand staring upwards in the company of someone else given to that activity, stonecarver Chris Pelletieri, keeping his craft alive in an era when even the neo-Gothic is prehistoric, has been Pelletieri's calling. He's been carving a space and much decorated stonework away from the robotic stone-carving machines that have become the standard. Culture Files' Vanessa Noonan visited Pelletieri at his Stone Carvers Academy.
I like the way that everything is sort of beige from the dust. It gives everything a unifying beige.
My name is Chris Pelletieri, and I'm a stone carver and a stone carving teacher. We're in my workspace in the Bronx, New York City, and beautiful cold day. So I was born in New York City in 1966 in Morningside Heights neighborhood, which is home to the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and Columbia University. And I grew up conscious of the beautiful stone buildings all around me. And I went to standard education through high school and college. I went back to the cathedral because when I was 12 years old, they had resumed construction on this building, which was started 125, 130 years ago, but they had stopped building. And they resumed construction in 1979, and they brought together some artisans from Europe to train local people. And I became an apprentice, and I immediately fell in love with the craft of stone carving and wanted to keep doing it for the rest of my life. And unfortunately, the construction of the cathedral stopped just a few years later, and I became self-employed and freelance. But I was lucky and privileged to be able to continue doing it and finding a demand for my work, not an overwhelming demand, but enough to keep me going. So I kept doing that for another 25 years, and I'm still doing that, but 10 years ago I branched out and I decided to start an organization to share the activity and the craft and the tradition with people like I was when I discovered it, and try to help people's lives and help the craft to continue to exist. When you work with stone or any material, you know, your work is visible, and the piece of material you're working on changes over time, sometimes very, very slowly, or if it's a project that takes months. The stone, you know, it's different from glass or metal that you have to heat it up and then you can work on it while it's hot. Stone's always there. You can, sometimes I carve into something which was part of a building which was built, you know, 100 years ago. And the stone itself was born a million years ago. And so, like, time is like, you can come back the next day and everything's exactly as it was. You know, when I work with clay, it dries out, and you come in the next day, and you're, oh, come on. Yeah. You're not stone.
You
know?
You like its permanence.
Yeah, I like that it's the same tomorrow, same as it was yesterday, and when you take a break, you jump right back in where you were. And the thoughts even come back to you. Like, if you were thinking about something while you were doing your work, and then you left the workspace and stopped thinking about that, you come back to the stone, and you pick up the tools, and you're like, oh, my gosh. It's like my brain just reverted to where it was, you know, 18 hours ago, and I'm like, it's weird. Sometimes it's unpleasant because you didn't really like the thing you were thinking about. When I was a student, you know, the longest time I'd spent on anything as a student was, I don't know, like 15 or 20 hours spread out over a whole semester where I'm, you know, going for, I don't know, a couple hours here and there and adding to something and revising it, and, you know, that's nothing. That's like 2 days of full-time work. So if you're working full-time, 8 hours a day on something over a period of weeks or months, you're like, oh my God, look what you can accomplish. And it's really nice to be challenged to put in that much energy into something and say, wow, look what I can accomplish when I have the ability to focus on something and really do my best. All animals have attributes that make them special, and like dolphins have this amazing ability to swim and be acrobatic in the water, and the memory and the language and the hands. Those are human things. I've always felt like to use what you've got, as an individual, but also as a species, is the path to fulfillment. At least it is for me. And I think it's true for most people. The culture today is like really craft is like on the margins, but it used to be big because anything that was existed, any object, was made by hand before industrialization and machines. So like what percentage of the population was engaged in actually making objects, either like dwellings or tools or food or whatever, must be like 75-80%. And now it's like that just got snuffed out. This is going back 100,000 years, and now it's like in 200 years, it's like, oh, you make stuff? That's interesting. I never met anybody that makes stuff. So like, I feel like craft, I don't know how you define craft as opposed to art. You know, I'm sick of those distinctions, but like if dolphins decided, you know, forget about this swimming thing. It's unthinkable. But if an animal with attributes decided, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. Yeah. We're going to start being like manatees and just hang in the water and wait for the food to come to. I don't even know what manatees do. Maybe they graze on the plants at the bottom of the river, but they don't do what dolphins do. And it's unthinkable that an animal would change its behavior patterns because of something better came along. But that's what humans are doing. We are giving up something which is an integral part of our natural behavior. And I don't think most people even realize it because it's kind of slow. It took a long time.
If I had a favorite artist, it would probably be this guy who carved this. It's just so beautiful. In the book, his credited as Nicholas von Leyden.
Is this from the cathedral or just?
Well, they have a museum next to the cathedral where I think they display this because it was taken off the cathedral for some reason and maybe replaced with. It doesn't look like it's deteriorated at all. I mean, look at these details, but for some reason it's in the museum next to the cathedral, whereas it used to be on the fabric of the cathedral. There's a lot of that in Europe. They
took
constantly taking pieces off that are deteriorated usually.
And just popping them,
putting them in the museum, and then
one really dangerous thing also that's happening is like since almost everything in our environment is machine made, when you do set out to do a craft, you compare it to like auto body or something that's like just perfect. It looks like it was just created out of thin air with a wand. Auto body is like glistening and there's no tool marks. So if you try to carve stone and your surface that you try to make a flat surface is like, oh wow, it's got all these tool marks in it. There's places where I dug a little too deep. There's probably places where I should have taken away a little bit more. You feel inferior and you feel like it's very humbling. And I think when machines came in like Victorian times, there was also a very, very strong craft tradition where people were like apprenticing at like age 13. So like they'd be really amazing craftsmen by the time they got to be adults. And at the cathedral, which was most of the work was done in the 1920s or 1930s, the standards of craftsmanship are like mind-blowing. But this is a neo-Gothic cathedral. It's like a building which was designed, patterned after Gothic cathedrals that were built in like the 1200s. If you go back to the real Gothic buildings and you look at the craftsmanship there, you find it's a lot more like human. It's a lot more like imperfect. And I really like that. And it's the same with like inscriptions. If you look at the Roman inscriptions from whatever, the second century or something, it's got a lot more human imperfection and irregularity, and that really appeals to me.
produce this curious effect of making you aware of the polarity of things. When somebody says something's real psychedelic, they mean bizarre. When the National Magazine was trying to illustrate the effect of these chemicals with various photographs, they come on with blurred photographs, all sorts of things, higgledy-piggledy, messed together. If you wanted some sort of appropriate illustration, you would have one very simple solution. You would publish the most gorgeous color reproductions of Persian miniatures and of Moorish arabesques and of the illuminations of Celtic manuscripts. That would give you the story.
The other music of James Larter there, and that was called Polarity from his album by the same name. And before that, you heard The Chisel Fall at the Pelletieri Stone Carvers Academy in the Bronx. And finally, this time, Paddy Woodworth, book in hand. And for his latest suggestion of some essential nature writing, Paddy is drawing our attention to a volume by the historian William Cronin, Changes in the Land.
Changes in the Land is a deceptively simple title for a complex and influential book from the early 1980s. Bill Cronin launched his stellar career as an environmental writer by exploring the interrelationship between humans and ecosystems throughout the post-colonial history of a region whose very name, New England, suggests wishful thinking about environmental identity. He claims his thesis is simple too. The shift from Indian European dominance in New England entailed important changes, well known to historians, in the way these people organized their lives. But it also involved fundamental reorganizations, less well known to historians, in the region's plant and animal communities. There were, as he makes clear at the outset, two fundamentally opposed views among white people as to their impact on the environment they had colonized. Henry David Thoreau saw the widespread extinctions of so many of the nobler animals, from wolves to beavers, as an impoverishment. Is it not, he asked in the 19th century, a maimed and imperfect nature that I am conversant with? The majority white view was very different. Two centuries before Thoreau, the historian Edward Johnson was already thanking God for having enabled the transformation of a remote, rocky, barren, woody wilderness so quickly into a second England for fertileness. As Cronin puts it, this transformation betokened the planting of a garden, not the fall from one. Cronin's evidence, however, shows that both arguments overlook two fundamental facts. First, ecosystems themselves are constantly, if slowly, transforming their compositions over time. Nature is not a passive player in the changes in landscape, but the source of many of them. Secondly, Native American Indians were not noble savages, environmental innocents. Like all indigenous peoples, they altered landscapes to their own uses and tastes, and not always to the mutual benefit of either their culture or the nature it was interacting with. The widespread Indian practice of burning forests to create savannas with enhanced hunting and agriculture were often effective for example, but they also sometimes went much too far and destroyed the very resources they were trying to enhance. Colonial exploitation causes much misery and damage, but it does not have a monopoly on degrading ecosystems. Cronin's richly textured explorations of both the natural and cultural history of New England manages to get across challenging ideas while remaining accessible and often entertaining. He is essentially popularizing the then new field of ecological history, which assumes a dynamic relationship between environment and culture, one as apt to produce contradictions as continuities. He succinctly summarizes this dialectic. Environment may initially shape the range of choices available to a people at a given moment, but then their culture reshapes that environment in responding to those choices. Changes in the way that people create and recreate their livelihood must be analyzed in terms of changes not only in their social relationships, but in their ecological relationships as well. He declares that our project must be to locate a nature which is within rather than without history, for only in so doing can we find human communities which are inside rather than outside nature. This is the high board from which he dives into the detail of nature and culture's dance in New England, starting with the colonists' ecstatic discovery of an abundance of fish, fowl, and fauna that had long vanished from Europe and would not survive their presence for very long. He demonstrates how Indians rapidly intensified their hunting of big mammals in response to the demands of the European fur trade. This led to many local and regional extinctions, with their own impacts in turn on the dynamics and vegetation of the ecosystems they inhabited. He points out how the catastrophic decline in Indian populations, due largely to European-born diseases, caused a temporary reforestation due to abandonment of Indian burning practices. But the new and the old forests were then cleared on an unprecedented scale by the white settlers, leading to the degradation of the very soils they wanted to farm like they had in England. Forests make soil as much as soil makes forests, Cronin reminds us. His book is an elegant exploration of history and ecology. It would be instructive to see his methods applied more frequently to our own landscapes and history.
Paddy Woodworth's Naturalist Bookshelf there, this time featuring William Cronin's Changes in the Land. And that brings to a close this edition of Culture File. We'll be back next time with Colm Tobin in the comfort zone, when we'll be settling on the Sicilian town of Siracusa in the company of novelist Ferdia Lennon, whose book Glorious Exploits was set there in ancient times. Till then, bye now.